The reason why there's so much suspicion about Iran's motivation is this. Iran mines uranium. And they've also said that they want to have 8 nuclear power stations for energy generation. The problem is that if you take their amount of uranium and you figure the enrichment to nuclear fuel, low-enriched uranium, they would only have enough uranium to power their energy system for 15 years. Now, they say that they want a completely indigenous system, and so it doesn't make sense to invest this much just for 15 years, especially if, for one-third of the price, they could update their gasoline pipeline network and their refinery capability and provide more than enough energy for perhaps 100 years.
Well, it seems that there is a deep and growing suspicion in the world about Iran's nuclear intentions and the military direction of Iran's nuclear intentions. You spoke today at a Lowy Institute function with the theme, how do we prevent a nuclear Iran? Is it indeed too late to prevent a nuclear Iran?
I don't believe it's too late. Already we see successful strategies for delaying the nuclear program. Some might attribute that to sanctions. Some might attribute that to other more covert activities, such as these computer viruses, which have gotten headlines. However, there's other strategies which we could undertake. The basic problem in Iran is not the people of Iran. They tend to be far more moderate than the government. And therefore, the question is, how do we make the government in Iran more accountable to the people? And this is one of those reasons why I would suggest that we should be doing a lot more to promote the independent trade union movement in Iran in order to create a mechanism in which the government is much more accountable to the people.
So do you actually see a potential for the trade union movement in Iran to play a similar role to Solidarity in Eastern Europe with the fall of the Iron Curtain?
Indeed. Throughout the Middle East, most unions are not independent. They're run by a Ministry of Labor. In 2005, we had our first independent trade union form in Iran, the bus drivers in Tehran, and unfortunately, the Bush administration and the larger international community missed potentially a Gdansk moment, a Lech Walesa moment. But since, we've had a second trade union form, and the question is, what are we doing collectively to help them organize and support them? Because both socially and also in terms of national security, they are essential to moderate the Iranian government.
The prospects of dissent in Iran don't look particularly good at the moment. There had been a flowering of liberal thinking in Iran, but it seems that it's being cracked down on in quite vicious ways.
Indeed, and what I fear is that we have a misconception now in the West that once the genie of reform is out of the bottle, that it can't be put back in. But when you look at the demography of Iran, the birth rate in Iran now is only half of what it was in the 1980s during the Iran-Iraq War, which means when we think back to the June 2009 post-election protests, most of the people on the street were those 20-year-olds. Once they become 30-year-olds and start families, they're not going to go out on the street. And what the Revolutionary Guard is saying in their own newspapers is if only we can hold on for another year or two, our job will become easier because we will survive and we will be past this demographic hump.
So what are ways then that the West could intervene to support those who want change, the dissidents, without actually provoking some kind of larger conflagration, without it actually becoming a military conflagration potentially?
Well, indeed, and that's a $64 million question, if you will. But there's certain strategies we can do. We've already discussed the labor union movement. One of those other issues has to do with independent media platforms. What are we doing to broadcast in Iran with a strategy? What I would argue is outside broadcasters, whether it's BBC Persian, whether it's Voice of America, or any other broadcaster, should have as their filter, they should be reporting what Iranians aren't allowed to report because of self-censorship.
Social media is playing a role. Indeed, on this program with the regular presenter, Mark Colvin, this has been covered extensively, the role of Twitter and the like in getting out information from behind the wall, so to speak.
It's not even simply Twitter, although that's hugely important. When I was in Tehran and when I was in Isfahan, I would actually be in houses that would receive calls from Israel, among other countries, where Iranians could talk to their family members back and forth, and they would go through third parties, through independent media platforms, and so forth. Likewise, Iranians are the top callers in, and the highest-ranked program in Iran is actually the Voice of Israel Persian Service, which is ironic because they do talk shows much like this with callers who are able to actually call in, and there's an interaction there.
Is all this a little bit optimistic, though, given that what we've seen is that the Arab Spring seems to be becoming quite cloudy? It seems to be diminishing the protests that we're seeing throughout the Middle East.
Well, let me make an analogy here. When we look back on the Islamic Revolution in Iran, too often people look back at it as an instantaneous event. But between the time when Ayatollah Khomeini came back to lead the revolution and the time the American embassy was seized was over 9 months. So what we're seeing in the among the Arab states is really the end of the beginning rather than the beginning of the end. And there's many different policies we could implement during this interim period to try to massage the process to the best possible outcome.
There's been criticism recently of Israel in relation to Iran, that this is the time actually to be taking a softly approach rather than staunch calls, military threats, because it has the capacity to actually soften the rhetoric and stop the regime in Iran from actually basically casting attention away from dissidents and the push for democracy and focusing on the outside. What's your view on that?
Well, Israel will look at the Iranian issue as an existential threat, not simply being strategically untenable, such as the United States, Europe, and perhaps Australia look at the threat. But the nightmare scenario in Israel is this. Should Iran develop nuclear weapons, many people will say, well, deterrence can work, containment will work, because the Iranian regime isn't suicidal. If we accept the point, there's still an important problem. What happens if you have domestic unrest in Iran like we had in June 2009, but instead of the Revolutionary Guard putting down the protests, you have the regime really start to collapse, sort of like what occurred in Romania in 1989? In that case, you have a very real problem in that the most ideological elements of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which would have the command and control over the nuclear weapons, might launch figuring suicide's not an issue. They're going to be gone in 6 hours anyway, and the Western world isn't going to retaliate against a country that's already had regime change. This is why the Israelis feel so strongly that Iran can't be allowed to develop nuclear weapons, because they fear that there's too many holes in this concept of containment and deterrence.
And that regime change, and in fact that's something that could ultimately lead to regime change, could destabilize to an extent where things become very, very dangerous.
Well, ultimately, I do believe that the problem in Iran is more the regime than the people. When you had the Islamic Revolution in 1979, a full 10% of Iranians took part because they accepted the promise of Islamic democracy. What they got was neither Islamic nor democracy. But should Iran have a change in government system, I would argue that Iran will be a pillar for stability, because the people have been immunized against this idea that any of these wild isms will provide, these political ideologies will provide any easy solution. I think we're going to have a deeply nationalistic Iran, but ultimately an Iran which will stabilize the force. They're not going to embrace Islamism, and they're not going to embrace populism.
How does the electoral system fit with that, though? Aren't there constraints within the electoral system, even if we were to move towards fully free, fair elections, to reflecting that basic liberalness in Iran?
Well, certainly there's a lot that can be done with various electoral systems. Iran actually has a history of elections going back more than 100 years now. But one of the interesting places where we can impact the electoral system and have a fundamentally different outcome is with regard to Egypt right now. Most Egypt analysts will say that perhaps 80% of Egyptians believe the Muslim Brotherhood should be allowed to run in elections, but that they only have a constituency of around 25%. If you have a first-past-the-post election system in Egypt, then that 25% could be enough to dominate the country, but if you have a proportional representation election, then you can have some serious checks and balances and advance democracy. The question I have for American policymakers and perhaps Australian policymakers is, what are we doing to try to have electoral system reform, not only in places like Iran, should that become an issue, but also in Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, Syria, and so forth?
Well, Britain failed to get in a system of proportional representation, so perhaps the prospects in the Middle East aren't going to be too strong.
Actually, within the Middle East, there are many countries which do embrace proportional representation, but I would also argue that for us, the stakes are higher in how they can impact the outcome of elections in Egypt and some of these nascent states which have a new opportunity than they are in some European countries.
Realistically, what do you think the threat is that we could actually see nuclear war in the Middle East?
There's always a threat, and any threat, no matter how small, is a bit too much. What I worry about is two issues. Number one is the issue that wars in the Middle East aren't caused by oil, and they're not caused by water. They're caused by overconfidence. And if the Iranians are able to develop a nuclear weapons capability, two things will have happened. The Iranians will have defeated the combined efforts of the international community, and the nuclear non-proliferation treaty will more or less disappear because we're going to have a cascade of proliferation. That, to me, is the greatest danger, and something which is more on the distant horizon. If, God forbid, anyone does use nuclear weapons in the Middle East, how do we reassert the stigma which is associated with the use of nuclear weapons? The analogy I would often make would be towards car bombings or airplane hijackings. The first time one happened, it was headlines. The second time one happened, it was buried in the back of the newspaper. We can't take that chance when it comes to nuclear proliferation.
I just want to head back to a point that we were discussing earlier. Sanctions. What do you think is the most effective sanctions policy for Iran?
The targeted sanctions are very useful. But ultimately, one of the sanctions ideas which is being bantered about right now has to do with gasoline sanctions, not on export of gasoline from Iran, but actually import. Because even though Iran floats on a sea of oil and gas, they have to import about 40% of their gasoline products. And every time they've had a shortage of gasoline, there's actually been people coming out in the streets, not blaming the international community, but blaming their own government.
Isn't there a danger, though, that if you do actually target things such as gasoline or air flights, that you could actually disenfranchise the people from the West? Their perception could turn to a concept that they're actually being punished by the rest of the world.
I would argue that if there's any military action against Iran, Iranians would rally around the flag. But there's been no evidence to date, and we've had any number of sanctions on Iran since the Clinton administration, which was actually the toughest American administration when it came to Iran, and we haven't seen that backlash. If anything, there's consistency in that the Iranian government, the Iranian people truly do blame their government for the economic inefficiency. They just don't trust them when they try to blame the West.